Ladies and gentlemen, welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will on AmericanFreedomRadio.com and incidentally the VinnieEastwoodShow.com, proudly brought to you in a, well, wonderful little coalition with GorillaMedia.co.nz and American Freedom Radio. Ooh, it is hot in New Zealand and it is wet in Australia and it is freezing in the north. Extremes of the extremes, particularly if you go to GorillaMedia.co.nz, the amazing footage of a Toowoomba flood in Brisbane, Australia. Freaking believable, man. Very, very quickly does this flood water rise and just start washing away them cars. Really freaking biblical out there, bro. I was half expecting some large bearded individual to float down the river on an ark. Oh, the disaster. Pretty rough, I would have thought. And supposedly, there's billions and billions of dollars worth of damage going to be done. And the floods have not stopped. In fact, they're even getting worse. Brisbane, very, very large city in Aussie, is indeed experiencing an awful lot of flooding as well. And meanwhile, everybody in New Zealand is kicking back in the sun, eating popsicles. And whilst some of the people in Australia are trapped, I was just listening to the BBC before I came on the show today, quote, there's nothing else to do, so I'll just have a beer. That cracked me up, man. That's the Aussie spirit. Or rather, the Aussie lager. Oh, yeah. And also a big shout out to our fabulous listeners and those people who are chatting away, going absolutely ape on the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will Ryan Facebook group chat that we have running behind the scenes on each show every day. And also, in other news, we wanted to interview Charlie Veach as well. He's been putting out some new videos. He's come back to the UK, the fabulous surveillance state. And indeed, this morning, I was sent a list of conspiracy theorists of Aotearoa by the Skeptic Society, apparently. And Will, you made it into the list. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will on American Freedom Radio. We'll be right back.
Well, there's only one thing I need to know. Whose side are you on? I got some so-called friends. I'll smile right to my face. All when my back is turned, they like to bury me without a trace. Oh no, no. Oh no, no. There's only one thing I need to know. Whose side are you on? I'm flying a JFK. My heart goes boom, boom, boom. I know that customs man, he's gonna take me to that little room. Oh, no, no. Oh, no, no. There's only one thing I need to know. Whose side are you on? Whose side are you on?
Welcome back. Welcome back to the show that's all about the paranoia blues. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will on American Freedom Radio, Guerrilla Media, and the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. Cruise in there and have a look at the archive section, and you will see a heck of a lot of interviews with activists and researchers that you have never heard of but will want to hear more of. Another person that we have on the show, on the line actually, is Edward Haslam. His website, ladies and gentlemen, is drmarysmonkey.com. That's drmarysmonkey.com. Edward, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you very much, Vinny. And it's Haslam, by the way.
Haslam! Oh! Okay. Dang!
No, it's all right.
I usually get the names right about maybe 80% of the time, but somebody slips through the cracks.
Well, we didn't have a chance to talk in advance. But at any rate, that's what it is. It's Haslam.
It is what it is. All right. So, Mr. Haslam, what's your favorite area of research, and what's Dr. Mary's Monkey all about?
Well, Dr. Mary's Monkey started out as an investigation into a cold case murder in New Orleans that happened back in the 1960s. There was a doctor who was murdered. Her name was Dr. Mary Sherman, and she's the Mary in the title, Dr. Mary's Monkey. And as the subtitle to the book reads, it says, you know, how the unsolved murder of a doctor, a secret laboratory in New Orleans, and cancer-causing viruses are linked to Lee Harvey Oswald, the JFK assassination, and emerging global epidemics. And so what happened was, way back in the 1990s, I started investigating this one murder. And this one murder, the more I investigated it, the more I realized that this was like the keystone in the arch. This was the central murder around which all these other stories evolved. And I had also seen a report in the media way back in the 1960s that this woman, Dr. Mary Sherman, had been working with David Ferry. And this report was done by Jim Garrison, who was the man who was investigating the JFK murder and Oliver Stone made the movie about. And he said that he had connected these two with some other doctors in an underground medical laboratory doing cancer research. Well, it turns out that this Mary Sherman woman was a professor at Tulane Medical School in New Orleans, and she was in the Department of Orthopedic Surgery, even though her specialties were cancer and radiation. And my father was a professor of orthopedic surgery at the same medical school, and my father was a very good friend of this woman and a professional colleague. And so when she was bizarrely murdered in 1964, it was a real shock to my father and a real piece of news in the family. But what all that nets out to is the fact that I knew who Mary Sherman was. And most of the people who saw this claim that she was connected to David Ferry didn't. Now, David Ferry was a wild right-wing radical who was involved in violent terrorist activities in Cuba against the Cuban government, and he was, you know, dropping napalm and stuff like that on people down in Cuba. And he was a professional pilot, and he was all associated with all those crazy anti-Castro Cubans. But Mary Sherman, on the other hand, had really no political agenda. If anything, she was a liberal, but she was one of the top cancer researchers in the country. And she was from the University of Chicago. She was chairman of the pathology committee of the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons. So I was left with this bizarre question that said, what is this top drawer cancer researcher doing involved in an underground medical laboratory with this political radical? And the obvious concern there is that they were doing something with cancer, like a biological weapon. And that concerned me, frankly, way more than the assassination of the president or anything. But so I started researching that, those angles, way back in the 1990s. And, you know, I was concerned because I heard they were using monkey viruses. And I started to ask the obvious questions, who did this woman work for and what were they involved in and all this stuff. And I discovered that she worked for this guy by the name of Alton Ochsner, who was a raving anti-communist in New Orleans. He was a founder of a great big hospital. He had all kind of a 30, 40-year history of secret assignments working for the United States government. And he was involved in shipping anti-Castro propaganda all over South America. Well, this adds another dimension to it, and then I find out the guy's got some kind of connection to Lee Harvey Oswald. And
yeah, well, this is the interesting thing, right? A whole bunch of things go back to JFK. It's like we're doing the time warp, and it's the Rockefeller Horror Picture Show here.
What a great line. Well, at any rate, so the more I dug into it, you know, I discovered there were lots of things going on. One of the most serious things I discovered was that this whole story went back to the polio epidemic and the polio vaccine. And then I found out that
Or more operatively, the polio vaccine epidemic.
Yeah, well, that's almost a third category in there, yeah. And what I found out was that the vaccine itself was grown on monkey kidney cells. And when they took out the monkey, polio virus to make the vaccine, they got every other virus that was in the monkey kidneys. And this was part of the production of the polio vaccine. The public generally was not told about it. One commentator did interview Salk, and he said, "Dr. Salk, the only thing I know about your vaccine is it starts off in a monkey's kidney and winds up in a child's arm, and you're telling us it's safe." Well, after they had released 100 million doses of the polio vaccine here in the United States, two researchers up at the National Cancer Institute discovered that there was a cancer-causing virus in the polio vaccine. And they had already released 100 million doses, and they still had another 100 million sitting on the shelf. And the idea that they had just mass inoculated the entire American public, and then some, with a cancer-causing virus was like the worst news anybody could ever imagine. And so they were not real interested in telling the world what happened. And they decided they were going to keep it a secret. And not only were they going to keep it a secret, they needed to get really busy with trying to come up with a cure before the public found out what happened. And so,
well, and of course, the viruses in the vaccines was in fact admitted by vaccine researchers and things like that who in fact developed them.
I'm sorry, re-explain the question again.
Well, I remember watching a video of one of the vaccine developers admitting that they purposely put cancer viruses into vaccines.
Well, they at the time it was in there, they did not think that those viruses caused cancer. And the problem was the vaccine was developed in the early 50s and released in 1955. And it wasn't until 1957 that the researchers at the National Cancer Institute discovered a cancer-causing virus in their laboratory animals. And then once they announced that, they got a lot of funding and electronic microscopes and stuff, and they started cataloging all of the viruses that were in the monkey labs. And they discovered that this cancer-causing virus that they had was actually resident to the Asian rhesus monkey, and which was the monkey that they used to grow the polio vaccines. So they discovered this after they had already released 100 million doses, and their fear, of course, was that there was a epidemic of cancer coming. And, you know, we're sitting here in 2011, and in my book, I publish all the cancer statistics, and it's very clear to me that there's an eruption of soft tissue cancers that happens right after the polio vaccine. And it's a major eruption, and it's, you know, if my analysis, which says this outbreak of soft tissue cancers, which are the soft tissues involved are breast, prostate, melanoma, and lymphoma, and you could also throw brain in there, but I didn't for reasons that are kind of too technical to get into right now. But the point is, those four cancers, if those cancers are being triggered by the SV40 virus in the vaccine, as I think they are, and other researchers think it is. And in fact, one of them is Michele Carboni, who's an Italian DNA specialist who's working in the United States now and working with the National Cancer Institute. He has called SV40 the most carcinogenic or cancer-causing entity they have ever discovered. And so if this quid pro quo or cause and effect relationship is correct, we got back 15 cases of cancer for every one case of polio.
Ooh, well, that sounds like a wonderful trade-off, especially if you're a eugenicist.
Well, my real concern is I hate to accuse anybody of being a eugenicist, but some of the people behind this operation in New Orleans might easily be described as that. And so, you know, there's a real issue there. But at the time, in the late 1950s, I think they thought they had a responsibility to try to develop a anti-cancer vaccine, to try to develop a vaccine that would stop the SV40 and prevent the epidemic, and they wanted to get that research done before the public found out about the bad news and lynched them. So what they started doing was they started trying to develop a vaccine. And the way you develop the vaccine is, like in the polio case, they had heavy, medium, and light, and eventually they used polio light to create the vaccine to stop polio heavy. But in SV40, they only had one strain of it. It was all very strong, and so they needed to get it to mutate. And so they set up an operation down in New Orleans on U.S. government property using a linear particle accelerator, which is a giant radiation gun, to start mutating these monkey viruses to see if they could get a weaker strain out of it. And the problem is, right in the middle of when they're doing this, 1960-61, Castro takes over Cuba, and the Russians bring in the nuclear missiles and point them at New Orleans. And I lived in New Orleans at the time. It was very intimidating to have somebody point a nuclear missile at you, which, of course, the Russians knew because we had put nuclear missiles in Turkey and pointed them at them. And you know, Cuba is our Turkey, if you will, in terms of pointing at our underbelly, just like Turkey is pointing at the Soviet underbelly. And so we didn't like that any more than they did. And so what happens is they start trying to kill Castro to get rid of communism so they can get rid of the Russians and get rid of the missiles. And so the CIA comes up with all these ideas of how to kill Castro, and they even hire the mob to do it and everything else. And these people in New Orleans, who are connected to both of those people, decide that they're going to take the research that they've been doing on this cancer vaccine, which has been producing stronger viruses and not weaker ones, and convert it into a biological weapon. And at this point, and this happens after the Cuban Missile Crisis, which is October of 62. So in the spring of 1963, they get ready to ramp up this operation in New Orleans and staff it and create a biological weapon and test it on humans and then smuggle it into Cuba and try to use it to kill Castro. That's the game plan. And so, you know, this is what I wrote about in my first book, which I published in 1995, called Mary Ferry and the Monkey Virus. And then in about 2000, the year 2000, so 5 years after I published the first book, the phone rang, and it was 60 Minutes, the CBS News television show here in the United States, the big national news show. And they started asking me questions about this book I had written because they said they were investigating a woman who said that she was in this laboratory that I had written about. Well, that was great because I mean, in the sense that I had this story, but I didn't have a witness, and they said they had the witness. And then they started telling me that the witness was all tangled up with Lee Harvey Oswald. Well, that really kind of got my attention. I said, well, what kind of evidence do you have? And they said, well, she worked at Riley Coffee Company with Oswald at the same time he did. We got her employment stubs her paycheck stubs and her tax forms and all that other stuff. And she even starts working on the same day. She gets fired from the coffee company the day Oswald gets arrested on the streets of New Orleans. You know, back in August 9th of 63. So what happens is I wind up putting a couple of chapters when we published Dr. Mary's Monkey in 2007. It was basically my first book, Mary Ferry and the Monkey Virus, but I now had a witness. So I added several chapters based on the testimony of the witness to say there's two things that I know about this woman that really concern me. One is she worked with Lee Oswald at the Riley Coffee Company at the exact time that he worked there. Starting on the same day and almost ending at the same time. And the second thing is I know from documentary evidence that this woman that I'm talking about, that knew Lee Oswald, was trained to handle cancer-causing monkey viruses at one of the leading cancer research facilities in the United States. And I said the combination of those things really makes me concerned. And once I heard her story and she started telling me that she knew Dr. Ochsner and she knew Mary Sherman and she knew Lee Oswald and she was convincing to me about this, I added several chapters in my 2007 book. And then this past November in 2010...
And we'll get into this just after the break. Thank you very much, Edward. Stay on the line there. Ladies and gentlemen, it can be a little bit unnerving, and we'll be right back to do it a little bit more. Gentlemen, did anybody say let's get ready to rumble? Yeah, man. Crashing through the absolute BS that we usually hear on mainstream media. It's the Vinny Eastwood Show, my fabulous co-host Will, and also our fabulous guest Edward Haslam. Edward, welcome back.
Thank you very much, Vinny.
Would you please do me the honor of continuing, mate? Because for goodness sake, me and Will have just been sitting back here listening, absolutely enthralled. Can't wait to see what you've got to say next.
Well, we're talking about two books. One book is Dr. Mary's Monkey, which I'm the author of. The other book I edited and wrote the foreword to, and it's called Me and Lee, How I Came to Know, Love, and Lose Lee Harvey Oswald, and that's written by a woman by the name of Judith Mary Baker. And so what happens here in 1963 is they're getting ready to do this biological weapon project. And what they're doing is they're taking these cancer-causing monkey viruses and they're exposing them to radiation to kind of supercharge them, okay, zap them up. Then they're injecting them into mice. And then the mice get cancer very quickly, you know, in about a week. And the mice is, you know, get these tumors, right? And then they take the mice with the biggest tumors and they kill them and they cut them open, they cut out the tumors, and they throw them into a blender, just a normal kitchen blender, and they grind them up, and then they start making microscope slides and stuff out of it and recording all the data on the thing. And what they're looking for is the most aggressive cancer they can come up with, so they can use it as an assassination weapon. Meanwhile, the American Cancer Society is running around telling everybody that you can't give anybody cancer. Okay? It's a spontaneous generated disease. There are no cancer-causing viruses. I mean, that's what they're saying officially, so that when they give somebody a cancer to kill them, they can say, oh, that's not possible, right? And they're just creating this great lie. But at any rate, they know from the research that this woman did when she was still in high school. Take this. She's in high school. She's a senior in high school. When she was younger, she watched her grandmother die of cancer, and she says, I want to be the person that cures cancer. So she spends her entire high school life, she's a brilliant woman, doing these cancer experiments, and by the time she's a senior in high school, she has figured out how to give lung cancer to mice in 7 days. Now, this is faster than they're doing it up at the National Cancer Institute. So,
well, have you heard of Rick Simpson?
No.
The guy's curing cancer with high THC hemp oil. He went to the Cancer Society in Canada with his discoveries about it, and they said, sorry, we're not interested in a cure for cancer.
Well, cancer is one of the biggest businesses in America, you know? If you
it's coming up to be one of the biggest businesses globally. What have we got? 1 in 3, coming up to 1 in 2 people are going to have cancer in their lifetimes, according to many departments of health. It's a growing epidemic. It's almost as if it's unlikely that you won't get cancer in your lifetime.
Well, let's focus on the word you just used called epidemic, okay? Because here in the United States in the 1950s, there was a media hysteria over the polio epidemic, okay? Now, in the 1954, I think it was, or maybe 57, the polio epidemic peaked at about 57,000 cases a year, okay? There are currently in the United States about 1.5 million cases of of cancer. So we're talking about an epidemic that is like, oh, what's the ratio? About 30 times the size of the polio epidemic, yet the mainstream media in the United States is not using the word epidemic to describe it. We are in the middle of a cancer epidemic, and as you just pointed out, that ratio is, you know, which was 1 in 10,000 in our grandfather's day, and now is, you know, creeped up to 1 in 100, now 1 in 10, and now you're talking about 1 in 2 and 1 in 3 in a lifetime. That's an epidemic. And where is the mainstream media response to it? And as you say, it's and as I said also, it's a huge business, and you're talking about between $50 and $100 billion a year just here in the United States. So, you know, if I came along, you know, with a pill that cured cancer and it cost 50 cents per patient, you know, they would say, get out of here. You know, we're not interested in a cheap cure for cancer. We're making a fortune treating it the way we're treating it. And all the pharmaceuticals are selling all these chemotherapies and stuff. So it is the way it is. And, you know, I appreciate you giving some airtime to people who think they have a solution, but that's the politics of the situation. Now, back to the story with Dr. Mary's monkey. So they got this girl. She's a high school senior, and she's been doing these research things, and she's been getting chemicals and from the U.S. Army. And she's been getting advice and help from the top scientists in America. And she has figured out how to give cancer to laboratory animals faster than they're doing it at the National Cancer Institute. Let me repeat this. We got a 17-year-old girl in a dirt floor laboratory in Florida with no budget who is outperforming the multi-million dollar budgets of the most top people in America in cancer research.
And I think it's probably, it might have something to do with the fact that the people who have the top budgets have their top budgets because people who are interested in promoting the growth of cancer pay them to not find a solution.
Well, I'll let you say that. I'll let you say that, not me. But what happens is,
it's speculation on my part, of course. You know, I can't prove nothing here. But you know,
what happens though is this young girl. She's 17 years old and she's bold. And she thinks she's discovered something really important, and she wants the cancer people, and she believes in all this stuff. She wants them to know about her research, and so she crashes a press conference of the American Cancer Society that's being held in Florida, not far from her house. And
by chance, did she get hauled out by security?
She gets busted, and they're hauling her out. And the people in charge of the conference say, wait a minute. You know, everybody in this room are basically, you know, men in baggy, 50-year-old men in baggy gray suits, and we have a beautiful young woman who's looks totally out of place. Why is she here? And so instead of throwing her out of the conference like they were doing, the head of the conference went over and asked her, you know, honey, why are you here? And she said, well, I got some stuff I need to tell y'all. And they invite her to stay at the conference. And over lunch, she shows them all of her research. And they say, this is real, right? This is serious? And she said, yeah, I'll show you my laboratory. I've got everything documented. And so what happens is that guy picks up the telephone. And he's the vice president of the American Cancer Society. He's a former dean of the University of Minnesota Medical School. He picks up the telephone and calls his friend Alton Ochsner, who was president of the American Cancer Society, and says, Alton, you got to get down here and meet this woman, okay? So Alton Ochsner and this guy, Dr. Deal, and this third man, they fly down to St. Petersburg to meet Judy, and Judy shows them all their stuff, and they say, we want to see your lab. And she takes them back to her laboratory at her high school, right? And they look at her laboratory and her notes and her slides and everything, and they say, look, this is wonderful research, except for the fact that you got no idea how dangerous this is. You know, what you're doing is, belongs in a secure laboratory, and you're in a high school with no security, all right? We're shutting your laboratory down, and we're going to train you to do this properly. And that summer, she's just about to graduate, all right? That summer, so it's only about a month later, they bring her from Florida up to Buffalo, New York, and they train her at the Roswell Park Memorial Cancer Institute to handle cancer-causing viruses. All right? She is trained as a laboratory technician. Why? Because they got research they want done that they don't want to tell the world they're doing. And she becomes their secret weapon in this thing because she's got no degrees. She's got no right to have this knowledge. Nobody would believe that she was doing all this stuff. But they fund her through the National Science Foundation and the American Cancer Society. They send her to college. They pay her tuition. They pay her room and board. And she sends them reports on what she's doing. And she's researching melanoma, which is skin cancer. Its interaction with SV40, that's the cancer-causing virus, with in the polio vaccine, and with the exposure to X-ray. Okay? In other words, is X-ray triggering the SV40 to start the cancer? Because if it is, you got a real problem, because all the X-ray machines are now part of the cancer generation process. And they want to know what the answer is.
So you mean, like, if you've got these viruses in your body, they get activated if you go and have an X-ray? Like, if you break your arm, you go and have an X-ray, and then you walk out with activated cancer?
That was their question. That's what they needed to know. But they didn't want to ask that question in public. Can you imagine?
Because they're afraid of what the answer might be, you know?
Well, yeah, or even what the consideration of the question might be. I mean, just asking a question, you know? I mean,
what about mammary tissue? Because there's also a lot of mammograms and things like that that dose the sensitive breast tissue with this kind of thing. That would apply as well if it was the case too, wouldn't it?
Well, let's just say that's another show. I'm going to stick to my story and what I know is going on here, and that's we got a woman who's a teenager who is one of the top researchers in cancer in the country, and she's being funded by people like the former president of the American Cancer Society and the VP of the American Cancer Society and the National Science Foundation and the American Medical Association and all this stuff, okay? They're all behind her, okay? But she's doing secret research, and she, in 1963, she's at the University of Florida. And she's doing all of this stuff. And even the professors around her don't really know what she's doing because they're not supposed to. But she gets in the University of Florida with a telephone call, and she never even applied. I mean, this is the hardest school to get into in Florida. She never even filed an application. The senator, the U.S. senator, picked up the telephone and called the university and said, put her in. And that was after the semester had started. Okay, and that's the kind of connections and support this woman has. And then in March of 1963, she gets a telephone call from this Dr. Ochsner and says, Judy, and Judy's a sophomore in college right now, and there's 4 years here, and that's the second year, okay? She's got full 2 more years to go. Okay? He said, how'd you like to skip the last 2 years of college and start medical school in the fall? And when you get here, we'll pay your tuition and room and board, and we'll have you doing some research under Dr. Mary Sherman, who's like the top cancer specialist in the country. Would you like that, Judy?
Would you like all your tuition paid for free and be basically given a leg up into the hell-off establishment? I can imagine what her answer might have been.
And skip the last 2 years of college.
Okay. Oh, mate, now there's a bribe and a half.
Yeah, there's just one little thing we need you to do. We've got we need some help in New Orleans this summer. Would you come over to New Orleans, and we'll find you a place to stay and stuff? And work on our little project for us. It's not something we want to tell a lot of people about. In fact, we don't tell anybody about it, but we need you to do it. Would you like to do this? And that's what they offer her, and she says yes. So in April of 1963, she gets on a bus and goes from Florida to New Orleans, and she actually arrives a couple of weeks before they're expecting her.
And we will continue this story after the break. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for tuning in. His website, ladies and gentlemen, is drmarysmonkey.com. More from our very special guest after the break. There must be some kind of way out of here.
There must be some kind of way out of here.
Said the skeptic to the reasonable person. You know, isn't it ironic, really, that skeptics, demonizing conspiracy theorists, they're only skeptical of the alternatives. They're never skeptical of the mainstream. Our very special guest, Edward Haslam, is back on the line with us. Edward, welcome back.
All right, thank you very much, Vinny.
After she went to New Orleans, I'd like you to continue on with your story. Final segment here for you, my friend.
Yeah, we're talking about Judy Very, and she's 19 years old, and they've invited her to New Orleans to because she knows how to handle these cancer-causing viruses. And what they need is a technician that's been trained in proper laboratory procedure to go to basically a safe house, a secret location, where they're going to be cutting the tumors out of these mice and preparing them and sending them back for more radiation, and so that they can make this cancer more and more and more powerful. Okay, and they've got a cover job set up for her. They've got somebody lined up to take care of her as sort of a babysitter or a handler. In fact, this guy that they send over there to help her find her an apartment and show her to her cover job and make sure she gets to the laboratory and all that stuff safely, he's a former U.S. Marine, and he's been had intelligence training, and he is there. He's from New Orleans, and he knows the city, and he knows the politics, and knows the people. In fact, he was raised very close to the mafia in New Orleans, and so he knows that side of the equation, too. And the name of this ex-Marine from the mafia in New Orleans who helps Judy Vary Baker find her apartment and get a job and everything else, the name of the Marine is Lee Harvey Oswald. And
what an incidental connection there.
Well, it's so she is in. She meets Oswald in April, okay, and she is in daily contact with him, more or less, at least it's sort of every other day kind of contact for the next several months. All through May, they start working at this coffee company on May 10th, through June, through July, through August. And then in the beginning of September, in August, something happens. And what's going on that summer is they're making this biological weapon. And they start out with mice. And then they say, well, can we get this to work in a monkey? And they start using these monkeys from South America called marmosets. And, yeah, it's working with the marmosets. But marmosets are not real close to humans. So then they try it on African green monkeys, which are way more expensive to get, but they get them through Tulane and the Delta Regional Primate Center there, and they test the cancer on the African green monkeys, and it works. And then they say, well, okay, we're trying to kill Castro here. We need to know if it works on a human, and particularly if it works on a Cuban. Okay, so they find this guy who's a Cuban who's been convicted of murder. And he's waiting on death row at the Angola Penitentiary in Angola, Louisiana. And they say, okay, we'll bring him over to that mental hospital right there by Angola in Jackson, Louisiana, and let's inject him with the cancer weapon and see if it works. And so Lee Oswald and David Ferry and Clay Shaw get in a car and they drive up to Jackson, Louisiana for this purpose, and they're going to meet the prisoner coming in there. And at any rate, so this whole, they test the weapon and it works, and it takes 28 days to kill the guy, and he goes to, he dies. But Judy says, wait a second, I'm trying to find the cure for cancer. I'm not trying to murder people. You know, and she protests. And when she protests, they say, honey, you're out of here. You know, you already bought in, and now you just broke the rules. You're out of here. So go back to Florida and stay out of medicine. And that one thing that happened there in August absolutely ruined this woman's career. If it hadn't been for that protest, she'd probably be running the American Cancer Society or the National Cancer Institute today. But it did happen, and she was thrown out of medicine. And, of course, Lee was sent to Dallas at that point in time, and he was set up and framed for killing Kennedy. But thanks to David Ferry, Lee and Judy kept talking on the telephone secretly all the way up to the assassination. So Judy talks to Lee 2 days before Kennedy is killed, and Lee tells her that Kennedy is going to be killed, and he has penetrated the ring of people who's doing it, and Lee is a secret agent who penetrated the assassination of President Kennedy and had it flipped on him, and they framed him for it at the last minute. Now, the importance of this is realizing, can you imagine what Lee Harvey Oswald would have said if he had been allowed to walk into a courtroom?
He
knows who killed Kennedy. He knows the biological weapon in New Orleans, okay? He knows all the connections to the mafia and the CIA and everything. He is the most dangerous person to the establishment in America because of what he knows. They were trying to kill him on November 22nd. They missed. They killed him on November 24th, okay, because they could not allow him to talk. And that is what Me and Lee is about. And Me and Lee is basically, these two books are connected. Dr. Mary's Monkey will give you all the research background and set up the situation. But when you want to know the story of what happened to Judy, from her story, from her point of view, because she was the person who was with Lee Oswald on a daily basis for months prior to the assassination. He told her what he knew about the assassination before it happened. These are the two books that are going to change people's attitudes.
Oh, yeah. Thank you so much, Edward, for revealing such incredible information on the Vinnie Eastwood Show. Definitely be keen to have you on again sometime. His website, ladies and gentlemen, is DrMarysMonkey.com, and we will be posting the archive on the VinnieEastwoodShow.com later this afternoon, so you'll be able to re-listen and get some of that information repeatedly pumped into your brain. Hour number two coming up next with a very special guest, Gordon Duff. Solidarity, baby, on the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will on AmericanFreedomRadio.com and incidentally the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. Speaking of solidarity, many, many, many people out there are experiencing interesting weather, interesting political situations, particularly in Tunisia, where there are huge riots over unemployment and food prices at the moment, which will soon be coming to a town near you. Food prices keep getting bet on by the derivatives of death trader mother effers in Wall Street, who are pushing up the world food prices and making it extremely difficult for those who can barely afford to eat as it is. And this is as true in Africa as it is in New Zealand. Welcome back to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. Ladies and gentlemen, I am proud to announce we have a very special guest here who's been on the show before. His name is Gordon Duff, the senior editor of Veterans Today, who has a network of somewhat, 70-odd ex-military, ex-intelligentsia personnel under his straight-up command. Gordon, welcome back to the program.
Benny, well, how you guys doing?
Borderlining on fabulous is my party line, mate. You know that.
Great to hear you, Gordon.
Well, it's good to be with you guys. How are things? It's summer for you guys, isn't it?
Yep. We're sitting here stinking hot, sweating like a bunch of Rockefellers in Bohemian Grove.
Uh, I'm looking outside here, and the world is white.
Now you know how they feel on this.
That's what comes. Oh. That's what comes with global warming, Gordon.
Yeah, it's there's a serious failure of global warming here in the central United States.
I know, I know. Seriously, man. I mean, if global warming is no longer a bad thing, it's now a good thing, I reckon. So I reckon we need to promote global warming as much as possible so we don't have to, you know, force the fuel prices up ridiculously to heat our homes. Considering gas prices around the world are skyrocketing, not only because of the increase in consumption in the Northern Hemisphere due to the below hell freezing over temperatures, but also speculation over these particular things on the stock market is also leading
to an awful lot of price increases. You don't want to get me started in this because my normal day job is working oil and gas.
Well, there we go. What a tangled
web
we
see.
Well, I'm supposed to be doing this in Nigeria in just a very short while. I'm talking oil and gas with them, and then Iraq doing the same thing.
Wow, man. Well, you certainly are somewhat of a globe trotter, Gordon, which is good. We like to have you on the show. After the break, we really want to get into this this murder in Arizona. The gunman being somewhat of a, well, what does he look like? He looks like Glenn Beck, doesn't he? you know, just
he looks like Fester Adams to me.
Yeah, yeah, he's a Fester Adams, Glenn Beckish type thingy, whatever, but we're going to discuss
Crowley.
That.
Looks like Crowley.
Ooh, maybe he does.
Look at his eye sockets.
Gordon Duff, ladies and gentlemen, veteranstoday.com. We're going to get into all this and more after the break.
Black sunrise, shadow coming over the sky. Black sunrise, always gonna be a surprise, 'cause we don't know.
And welcome back. Welcome back in the pouring rain of the fabulous, ironically, desert state of Australia. You're listening to the Vinny Eastwood Show with Will. Our very special guest joining us live is Gordon Duff from Veterans Today. Gordon, welcome back to the program.
Well, it's good to be back. I enjoyed the break, the AMSOIL commercials. I'm an AMSOIL user.
How nice. Good little plug there. Well, now, your latest article, Murder in Arizona, Moral Flexibility and Relativism is the headline at veteranstoday.com. What do you mean by moral flexibility and relativism here?
Well, it's a variety of ways of, let's see, how do we describe this? Because this is evening, and that brain cell probably blew out with the last scotch. But one of the issues we've come up with here, and this is changing really rapidly, but we have a murder here, you know, no question. We have six killings. We have a seriously wounded public official. But instead of it being a crime, instead of it being a tragedy, we have essentially have a circus here. And the primary issue that's come out, and the most insane thing that's come out, has been, and all we're hearing here is Is the shooter Jewish? Is the victim Jewish? What does the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, think about Sarah Palin? As far as relativism, let's take a look at our congresswoman here, Ms. Gifford. Arizona is a strange place. Discussing this, of course, Australia is a strange place. But Arizona is a place where you can wear a gun on your hip, carry a machine gun, and walk down the street legally. People look at it. You can, I'm not sure you can point it at people, but you can probably point it at people. In politics, Arizona is an area of extremes, people that are very outspoken, very independent. Every lunatic fringe organization from anti-Semites to Zionist extremists.
To veterans today.
Yep. They're all out there. And we've got a member of Congress that's a very much a liberal, very much a nice person, mind you. One of our writers actually was an unsuccessful gubernatorial candidate in 06, Mike Harris, a good friend of Ms. Gifford's. Now, Gifford's, part of her moral relativism, as I see it anyway, it was her decision to, in order to win the election and get maybe $300,000 more dollars in her campaign coffers, decided she was going to discover a Jewish past. Now, by estimation, if people in the U.S. were honest about it, about 60% of the people living in the U.S. have Jewish relatives. We're all Germans. There isn't a German that isn't partially Jewish. You know, even the Nazi skinheads that we have about two dozen of that march up and down our streets, I'm sorry, none of them can stand scrutiny. This is going to be a cafe au lait world. Nobody's going to be white. Nobody's going to be pure anything. It's time people got over that, started talking about the real things we have to deal with. And we had a woman that could sort of do that. But in order to win a tight election against an extremist, supremacist, ultra-nationalist candidate, she needed she needed support. So one of the ideas of relativism here is that in order to get support, she not only found that she had a long-lost, generations-back Jewish relative, but she also discovered, after years of being deeply religious in a very strange Christian sect. I don't know if you're familiar with Christian Scientists, but they're a very strict sect. You'd let a child die before taking him to a doctor. It's that kind of group. Well, the moment she discovered she needed money, she also discovered that she didn't need Christ anymore. That's moral relativism. At the same time, she discovered a variety of other things, that the United States immediately needed to invade Iran. The day before, it didn't. The day after, it did. Iran didn't have nuclear weapons. $300,000 later, it did. Palestinians had a right to exist. $300,000 later, they suddenly didn't. And a very nice person, a person whose voting record in Congress was progressive, a person who certainly supported veterans, supported the poor, supported women's rights, suddenly became doctrinaire in accordance of her financial needs. Now, one of the probably the most painful part of this this incident in the U.S. is that the least controversial thing one could say about it is that it was a government conspiracy by a lone gunman, mind-controlled assassin. The stories have gotten so wild about this where the two political sides are accusing each other of really murderous acts that the least thing you could do...
Isn't that funny, Gordon? Like, some random nut job kill somebody, and all of a sudden, it's the fault of every single person who has a political opinion outside the norm.
it's going totally crazy, but it's not just that. It's ghoulish. We have the most extreme elements of our society. Sarah Palin, who's, I'm sorry, a dangerous psychotic, ranting and raving on TV and radio continually about this. And, you know, frankly, whether she, and this was one of the issues, you know, for your audience there, maybe unaware, but we had election advertisements that included, let's say, hunting and shooting related issues tied to eliminating one of these candidates that, or the member of Congress that was shot in the back of the head. Now, that's coincidental. It may have been somewhat irresponsible, but you watch television every day, and you just don't go out and get involved in car chases and jump out of airplanes just because you see it on television. There is such a thing as individual responsibility, and that's the you know, that's something I think we all need to, you know, and certainly do accept. However, the amount of complaining Palin is doing about this for two or three
What's her condensation of the whole event?
Well, she's calling it a blood libel, and she's now in a theoretical war with the Israel lobby. They're screaming and calling each other names continually. The only odd part of that is the people she's fighting with are her primary financial supporters, which gives me sort of a disingenuous feel that this is street theater here. From fanatics who like to, they would hijack any story. This didn't have to be a shooting. It could have been a school bus going over a cliff. She'd still be on television screaming. It doesn't matter what happens. The same idiots are on TV screaming the same things. Rush Limbaugh, Glenn Beck, Palin, and then our collection of left-wing nut jobs in the country, none of whom are even remotely related to reality. None of them have ever held a job in their lives, and certainly none of them are capable of any kind of critical thought.
Well, absolutely. I mean, with the body odor and the camouflage pants and the unscrumpled beards, I mean, seriously, these aren't just serious political commentators whatsoever. They're just basically nuts. And what I find really interesting...
Yeah, you're not referring to anyone in particular, are you, Vinny?
No, of course not. This is just general, because, you know, I'm a collectivist as well, right? Well, the interesting thing is because people in that kind of paradigm don't believe in any individual responsibility, you know, they believe that everybody's to blame for everything that goes on everywhere.
The capitalist system made this.
And instead of going, oh my God, a single nut job went and killed a whole bunch of people, we need to send that guy to jail and then death row, they say, oh, I'm going to use this as a platform to advance my own political agenda in a very disingenuous and quite frankly disgusting fashion.
Vinny, on the whole subject of who's to blame, I see a bit of both. You know, I see it as, yeah, this guy's a product of society. This guy was on hallucinogenic drugs. He definitely wasn't physically healthy, let alone mentally healthy. I mean, if you could judge him by his eyes, the guy's out on, you know, Venus. You know, he's
now here's the scary thing, though. You know, I know the photo you're talking about, the one that has that maniacal look about it. Now, if you go into any of our closets here, there are boxes of really bad photos that all of us have, you know. I think there are two or three photos of me that look worse than that. But matter of fact, I know it. I've tried to get every copy I could. The photo they're showing, I believe, is a photo that was taken when he thought he qualified to join the U.S. Army, which... you know, if you want to put that in context as being a crazed and maniacal act, I tend to think of that as a little off also. Now, can I get away with introducing,
because,
you know, I love doing
and,
this.
And with the conspiracy movement and Tea Party, when this guy was reading the Communist Manifesto and Mein Kampf, and
yeah, but
you know, he was completely
how do you do
on
this? You've got this individual here. He's like a man for all seasons for conspiracy. He's not only a left wing extremist; he's a right wing extremist at the same time. Matter of
so
fact,
that
I can't
makes him
think
just
of a single group
he isn't against. In general, doesn't it?
Well,
that would make him us, because we're not one side or the other.
We do have
it's
some
like
conspiracy
he's wrong on both counts, regardless. It's just hilarious.
Well, now, we do have some conspiracy inconsistencies here, and you do have an audience that loves conspiracy. I mean, let's face it, we all love conspiracy. Can we go into that area here?
I don't enjoy it. I don't love conspiracy. I just see it exists. I can't deny it. That's the problem.
Well, I'll tell you, without conspiracy.
I love conspiracy. You know, conspiracy gets me up in the morning. Conspiracy teaches me how to breathe, how to think, how to eat.
Of course. Well, this guy seemed to like an X-Files world because it gives him justification, like it gave purpose to him, it seems. I don't know. Maybe I'm reading too much into it.
Let's take a look at what happened, though, okay? Now, we had a political rally in Tucson, Arizona. Now, in Arizona, probably 30% of the adults in Arizona carry weapons. Now, I live in Ohio, and you can go to a grocery store here and buy a pistol and ammunition by just showing your driver's license. Anyone can carry a concealed weapon in Ohio that doesn't have too many criminal convictions. Anyone, as long as it fits under your clothes, you can carry it. And pretty much everyone does till they get sick of dropping pistols in the supermarket. Because it isn't that much fun carrying a gun if you have to. But let's take a look at who is at this rally. It's in the middle of Tucson, Arizona. We have two people there in particular. We've got this congresswoman who has been under continual death threats during her entire campaign, and we have a federal judge who is the single most threatened federal official other than President Obama in history. He received 200 death threats in one day. A federal judge, as his little worker bees, they're called U.S. Marshals. A bailiff for a federal judge is a United States Marshal. All federal judges have armed security. This federal judge had 24-hour-a-day armed security. Members of Congress are typically guarded by local police during events like this. And in any given case, during this rally, these are the things that should have been there. Two United States Marshals should have been there with the federal judge, his normal security detail. There should have been six police officers there. There were none. This member of Congress has a professional video team that videos every one of her public appearances and puts it on her YouTube site. They weren't there. The opposing party, the Republican Party, also hires a professional video team to follow her around, hoping she does something really stupid so they can put her on their video site. That team didn't show up. When the shooting started, and this is in the middle of an American city, and you know how many police we've got. New York City's got 37,000 police, larger than the army of, well, most countries. The closest police officer to this rally was 10 miles away when the shooting started.
So are there any ulterior explanations? Let's take the skeptic point of view and say, oh, everything's perfectly explainable, Gordon. So is there any explanation for these video teams not being there for a start?
No. And I have people that have traveled with her politically, have gone to events with her. And if you go on her YouTube site, you will see a significant number of her public events filmed, and she has a video team, and it wasn't there. In particular, not that this would have necessarily been better, but the first time you pull out a gun and shoot someone, two U.S. Marshals would have shot you, and then six police quite possibly might have shot each other in the process and everyone else, but none of that was there. And then the other odd thing is the individual here, and this is our let's travel down the and we have to do this. This is the conspiracy road, since everything else is worse. We have so many of these bizarre shootings that in the U.S. The Fort Hood shooting. We have a psychiatrist that buys a special operations high caliber pistol. On a military base, and just start shooting everyone down. And when we looked into his past, he was attending secret meetings with defense contractors and special operations groups in Washington. He was a psychiatrist. Certainly all of these people are Lee Harvey Oswald material. Insane. No question about that. But the young gentleman here, here's a really odd thing. We're in the middle of a war in the U.S., and pretty much if you show up at a military recruiter's office, you can see over 3 feet, and you haven't shot anyone that day, they're going to take you into the Army and send you to Afghanistan. That's pretty much the way things work here. Military recruiters have the highest suicide rate of anyone, of any job in the United States.
Doesn't sound unlikely, because when you're responsible for the deaths of your own people, it does make you feel very guilty. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. Our very special guest is Gordon Duff from VeteransToday.com. We'll be right back.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road, when along came a semi with a high-end canvas-covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca Mac with me, you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab, and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. I travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Padilla. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare.
Broadcasting everywhere, man. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will. On AmericanFreedomRadio.com, TheVinnieEastwoodShow.com, GorillaMedia.co.nz, and of course, Rush 89 FM in Hamilton. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back, and also welcome back to our very special guest, Gordon Duff from Veterans Today. Welcome back, Gordon.
Well, one of the things I'm pushing here, guys, is that in the U.S., it's more or less a safe bet. As soon as somebody tells you that it was done by a lone gunman, and they do it before the brass has stopped bouncing on the sidewalk, I'm going to raise the conspiracy flag until somebody could prove it didn't happen. It's where we go. It's where we're all starting to go, kind of right off the bat. But there's a context for this shooting that a lot of guys haven't seen, guys and gals haven't seen, and are you familiar with John Wheeler III? Does that name ring a bell with you?
Nope.
I've heard that name somewhere.
It's not supposed to. Okay, not supposed to at all. John Wheeler III's a Vietnam veteran, a Harvard grad, went to the U.S. Military Academy in West Point, special assistant to the Secretary of the Air Force, close advisor to three American presidents, in the defense establishment, one of the top people in the defense establishment, and one of America's foremost experts on biological and chemical warfare. A major Washington defense insider, and a really good guy, by the way. Now, about 8 days ago, this is supposed to be like a joke. He showed up in the back of a trash truck in bags. You didn't hear this, right?
No, not at all.
No, no. Assistant Secretary of the Air Force. The truck was just like on a TV show, dumping the trash out at the city dump, and out pops the Assistant Secretary of the Air Force, America's primary expert on germ warfare. Suddenly comes popping out of the back of the trunk, out of a garbage truck. Now, 8 days since, no police investigation, no cause of death, no newspaper stories, no one asking what happened to this guy. He was murdered, one of, in the U.S., in defense, in the Pentagon, one of the best-known people in one of the most controversial jobs. And I don't know if you know how many people around the world that work in biochem warfare get murdered, you know, like the suiciding of Dr. David Kelly in the United Kingdom. But it's a very dangerous occupation. Well, those of us who follow these things, and we, and this guy died, and we've been waiting for the police to come out and say we're looking at a suspect, or a meteor hit him on the head, or he was sleeping in a trash bin, and they threw him in the back of the truck, and he was crushed, you know, with his $1,000 shoes. You know, that we're looking for that kind of story, and instead we've gotten nothing. So I'm looking at this thing a couple days later in Arizona with a jaundiced eye because I've got this conspiracy going on in Washington tied to germ warfare. I've got stuff coming in from the Internet telling me that he was involved in the theft of nuclear weapons, according to Wayne Madsen. We've got very unreliable things from the Internet saying that he was involved in the mass death of birds and fish because of released poison gas over the U.S., which, even for conspiracies, I'm ducking that one. Stolen nuclear weapons, that catches my attention. And then a few days later, I've got a crazed killer with a plastic skull in his backyard, with some very strange videos that look like, well, somebody made them in about 15 minutes. Not the kind of things young people make. If you've seen the videos, they don't make any sense at all.
Yeah, I watched five of the gunman's videos, and it's exactly like you said. They don't make any sense at all.
Yeah. I don't know how old your kids are. You know, I've got kids that age. And that's not the music they put on their YouTube stuff. That's not pot-smoking music. That's Pentagon elevator music there. But let's look at this Army recruiting thing. In 2008, this guy shows up at an Army recruiter. He's obviously not very tightly wound, okay? And that's, you know, I don't think anybody can question that.
I'm surprised they didn't take him instantly.
Well, you know, that's kind of the point, you know, because one of the things that Julian Assange exists for is to remind the world that every member of the American Armed Forces is exactly like this young person. WikiLeaks has me convinced. I believe everything they tell me. But this kid in 2008 begins the recruiting process. In 2011, if you looked at his latest YouTubes, he still considers himself in the recruiting process. Now, where any other normal, illiterate, slightly convicted criminal can go down, and then 20 minutes later, they've given him a defective rifle, bad body armor, and they have him on a transport plane for Kandahar. 3 years later, this guy is still going down to the recruiting office, filling out forms, taking tests, or is he getting the magic mind control drugs that his YouTube videos seem to make a reference to?
And of course, there's no connection at all to MK Ultra here, is there?
Well, if anything, if I didn't believe in MK Ultra. And it's something I've, you know, if I don't know somebody that was involved in it personally, you know, I just tend to run away from it. This is like a flagship thing. It's like he walked in the recruiting office and there were two doors, left and right, you know. One says Patsy and the other one says Lone Gunman. And he went to the left door. And for 3 years, he is negotiating to get into the military. And during that time, he goes through behavior changes, we're told, where he stops drinking, he stops using drugs a couple of years ago, mind you, starts acting unusually, and, well, he did everything but move to Russia for a couple of years, create a double of himself, and go to Mexico City. I mean, this is a classic Lee Harvey Oswald. But we've seen so much of this stuff lately. The phony bomb plots in Yemen, the crotch bomber Christmas before last, meaning that we're, just a couple of weeks past Christmas. The Times Square bomber, we had this phony bomb plot where the FBI tried to convince us that some guy in Portland, Oregon was going to blow up the city's Christmas tree. And, I mean, that was an utter fabrication. Is it maybe that the nicest thing that we can expect of the American government is that if they're involved in false flag terror plots, that they be the jokes like the Christmas tree bomber and the Times Square bomber and the crotch bomber, totally inept people, and not send maniacs through parking lots, killing poor civilians, murdering small children?
What do you think of Judy Clark representing this Arizona shooter, the same person who represented the Unabomber, Ted Kaczynski?
She represented two, as far as I know, alleged MK Ultra subjects.
Well, if this were 10 years ago and we were talking F. Lee Bailey, who's a tough guy, and he's representing somebody, it's one thing. But in the United States, if you don't think that somebody, that a Men in Black character will walk up to a lawyer and say, if you don't do what we tell you to do, we know where you sleep, we know where your kids are, we know where your grandchildren are. This is the kind of threats we had come out on Jesse Ventura's conspiracy theory a few weeks ago, discussing 9/11. I don't know if you'd seen the video on that. But Pentagon employees that refused to say that they saw an airplane or airplane wreckage that didn't exist were told they were going to be killed. And I'll tell you, this is all turned into, it's all turned into an X-Files episode. However, if we were going to object about conspiracy theories and how unhealthy they are, the things that are going on with the people that are supposedly the political leaders in the U.S. are so disgusting. Now, the guys in politics believe that there's some kind of agenda that's going to come out of this shooting, that we're going to, everything is said to be, ready to unloosen a control of the Internet or an elimination of the alternative press, which I think we are. But, guys, 90% of the alternative press we learn from WikiLeaks are paid stooges of the regular press, like WikiLeaks turned out to be. We started out with this crazed WikiLeaks guy that's a hacker working with a gay lover that's stealing Pentagon secrets, and then 2 months later we find he's working for the New York Times.
And that came out in mainstream news that the WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange let New York Times decide what got leaked and what didn't, or rather what was reported on being leaked and what didn't.
Well, the more disgusting part of this is there is a network of people within the independent media. We have our own sort of associations. We even did top journalist of the top conspiracy freak journalist of the year awards, by the way, which I was on this year. But we all know each other, and what we're finding is the dozens of people that run prominent websites, we've got people that are coming to blows with each other because a lot of us are now totally convinced that many of the independent journalists around us are under the pay of intelligence agencies. And it would be different since being an independent journalist doesn't necessarily mean you're the sanest person in the world. And Veterans Today is, if anything, we've got, I collect military people, intelligence agents, and anybody who's been fired from a news agency for telling the truth eventually ends up with us. And that's, we're like the place where you run home to mama.
But, you take a rookie leak on the so-called independent journalists.
Well, but the independent media that this is exactly what we're doing right here, right now. The independent media is becoming worse than the regular media. I have people that have spent their lives saying that we hate Israel, we're going to... All of that's changed. When there's a party line thing, support Julian Assange, all of a sudden, we've got website after website saying the exact same things, the New York Times, The Guardian, which, you know, for our British audience here, The Guardian is MI6, you know, it's the spooks. It's where they put out press releases. The New York Times is the CIA's publication. Anything that's, you know, put out there as, you know, as any sort of foreign analysis comes right out of Langley, Virginia. And any American who doesn't know that kind of needs to know that. But the efforts that we've all been making for years and years, as these stories come out more and more, we are finding how thin our own ranks are and how few of us are that independent anymore. And it scares me. And it's but what is all this stuff ending up about? There is no story about the victims.
Yeah, they don't really care. I mean, it's totally disingenuous and ridiculous at best. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. Our very special guest is Gordon Duff from VeteransToday.com. We'll be right back.
We're gonna make love. You know how I know? Because it's Wednesday, and Wednesday night is the night that we usually make love. It's because it's when everything is just right. There's nothing good on TV. You haven't had your social netball team practice, so you're not too tired. Oh yeah, sounds like it's all on. You say something to me like, I might go to bed, I've got work in the morning. But I know what you mean. You mean, oh yeah, it's business time. It's business time.
It's business. It's business time.
That's what you mean. You mean it's business time. Oh.
It's business. It's business time.
Welcome back.
Oh yeah.
Oh, wow, 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 that's wow, right. Wow.
We go brush our teeth. That's all part of it. That's foreplay. You go sort out.
Foreplay with the New World Order. Kind of painful. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will, our very special guest joining us here for final segment of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio is Gordon Duff from Veterans Today. Gordon, welcome back.
Well, it's good to be back, guys. I'm enjoying radio with commercials and real sponsors in it, and good to see that you guys have the support you do.
Oh, yeah. And speaking of support, Gordon, do you have Facebook, mate? You should go to the Vinnie Eastwood Show with Will Ryan Facebook group and sign up, mate.
I'm going to remember to do that. So where do you want to go with this last segment here?
Well, I was going to go into oil, actually.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh, boy.
Oil, very good products. Fully synthetic motor oil.
I'm a long believer in synthetic motor oil.
But more specifically, oil prices are going up through the effing roof. It's just driving me nuts, which is why I'm not driving very much. I'd like to know your take. I mean, why are the prices so high?
It's entirely market manipulation. The U.S. economy, right now we're sitting here at U.S. dollars, where I am, between $2.90 and $3.15 a gallon for gasoline, which has to sound insanely inexpensive for you. For here, with where vehicles get 7 miles per gallon sometimes, and people drive 50 miles to work, for a job that pays $6 an hour, it's destroying people's lives. But as far as things are moving in the world, Iraq has oil cargoes they can't move, they can't give away. Now, this is an interesting thing, and I don't know if any of you work in oil at all, but there's an organization called Platts Market Scan that establishes the price of crude oil on a daily basis, dependent on the amount of sulfur it has, the API, the viscosity of the oil, and the API viscosity and the other sediments in the oil more or less tells you how much gasoline you get out of oil. An API 35, 37, very, very light crude, produces gasoline. The Russian stuff, which is heavier, produces diesel fuel. And both have a fair amount of value. But there is a huge glut of crude oil in the world, an absolute glut. We can't get rid of it. No one will buy it. Production capabilities. The world has more oil. There is more oil underground than anyone can remotely imagine. All of this oil shortage stuff, talk about conspiracy theory. If somebody needed 20 million barrels of oil a month, that's enough to run France. I could get you the contracts in a day. It's available. It's out there. Governments around the world are saying, we need money. We need to get our oil out of the ground. And yeah, we're all driving less. If everyone in the world is driving 5% less, and we certainly are in the U.S., because where are you going to go? Where I live, the actual unemployment rate in the town I'm in is 40% of the people are unemployed. 23% are receiving unemployment benefits. 17% additional estimated are people whose benefits have expired. We don't have rush hour anymore. You go to Britain, you could get on the M4 when you used to be stuck, you know, heading out to Reading for 45 minutes. Guys will tell you this. It's now a 15-minute drive. We're not using the fuel anymore. Why is the oil market the way it is? Why isn't oil $45 a barrel? Why is it $100? Yeah, you're totally right. The same thing with natural gas. It's not just that we have a tremendous amount of natural gas. It's that we have more liquefaction plants for delivering it. The market prices should be going down. We have new gas discoveries continually. Production levels in the Caspian Basin are through the roof. We have a huge new gas discovery in the eastern Mediterranean right off Israel, which they're trying to pretend it's not that much. Well, Israel has the ability now to produce $10 billion a year worth of natural gas, which they can sell into Western Europe. They're trying to tell people they don't have it because they want to keep getting the $3 to $5 billion a year of foreign aid from the U.S., when the U.S. ought to be borrowing from them. No, it's all a game, and anybody in the oil business will tell you.
Well, if anybody in the oil business knows this, how is it being kept from the public? Why is this peak oil scam hotting up? I mean, as far as I know, if you can create false scarcity, you can create a society that is willing to just basically do whatever you tell them to do and pay any price, because our entire society is totally addicted to it. Gordon, I'd like to thank you very much for coming on the show today, and can't wait to have you on next time, mate.
Well, I've enjoyed it. You guys are always a lot of fun. This is a lighter-hearted group than we generally have.
Yes, that's
right. We'd love to have you on for 2 hours, Gordon. But yeah, thanks for coming on today. It's been great. Always good to hear you.
And thank you, guys.
There he goes, Gordon Duff from veteranstoday.com. Ladies and thank you also very much for listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, The Lighter Side of Genocide. You can catch up the radio archives at the vinnieeastwoodshow.com. Also, have a look at our basic sponsors page, guerrillamedia.co.nz, for all the articles that you basically would have to trawl through a lot of different news networks in order to find yourself. Thanks very much for listening, and we will be back tomorrow, I can assure you.